We're here at the Edinburgh Fringe in the final week. I'm joined by
Tina Cronus
and
Richard Alger.
And the good news is that means that Theatre Movement Bazaar are back at the Fringe. And my opening question as we sit here in the grounds of Grey Friars Kirk is, a lot of mystics even today would say that the Grail Project is real and that it's ongoing. And that in terms of the big picture, you know, it's just part of a path of humanity, and the Grail means something. Now, whether we take that literally as the mystics might or take that symbolically, you've chosen this year to go into some pretty powerful imagery and myth, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. We are really fascinated by the Arthur legend and the Grail myth and wanted to take it on. We've always been interested in doing our interpretations and contemporizing other myths, and this one is sort of the backbone of Western mythology, and we thought that would be a great place for us to enter into and to find how it resonates with us today.
Now, build me a bridge from Tennessee Williams to that.
Well, they're all stories, right? And so we've done Greek myths, we've done Chekhov, we've done Tennessee Williams, basically anything that, you know, catches our fancy, and usually over a decade of catching one's fancy, we decide to turn it into an adaptation. It has to kind of bubble up over the years, and that's how this happened. I know for myself, this particular myth started to interest me in high school quite a bit. And so it's been bubbling around for I won't tell you how long.
having seen and thoroughly enjoyed and appreciated Grail Project, what that reveals to me, having seen a lot of your work, is you cast your net widely. You're a company that gives yourself a lot of permission, both in terms of the content and the genre.
Correct. Yeah, I would say so.
Oh, I got that's correct.
Yeah, that
why?
Absolutely. And yeah. And why do we do that?
Yeah, and how? You know, was that there right at the start? Or have you, I always use this word a lot, actually, unraveled, and that permission's grown over time? Or was it there on day one?
Well, I just know for myself that I came from a mime background where everything is allowed because it's all imagination, and imagination is boundless. So that's how I think about working with text and working with actors, working with choreography. There are no boundary limits for me.
And yet also, the permission you give yourself seems to have, and again, I'm not sure if this is just natural or you chose it, it always seems to respect its source material.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. And I think that's something we want to, we always like to embrace, because we're not sort of interested in creating thesis plays necessarily, but we love to respect, as you say, the original, and that allows all the great meanings that are within it to come out. And I think one of our trademarks is working, you know, humor into our interpretation of it. And the great thing is when you can let that deep, heavy meaning of these myths reside, but still bring humor out in how we think is funny in a contemporary way.
The arrival of microphones and stuff in recent shows suggests that at some point you've just added cabaret.
Yes.
But was that because you missed it, or because it wasn't there in some of the earlier stuff? You know, did you just suddenly go, well, we haven't added cabaret, or did you discover it?
Well, no, it just sort of appeared, didn't it? It just kind of happened. Like, I can't explain why. Can you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I wonder if it didn't come out when we did Big Shot.
Yeah, that was it.
I think it was. Our deconstruction of that, this novel and the films, really was kind of like approaching it more in a cabaret form. And this is sort of typical of how we work. You know, some things from the last project, you know, in terms of form, maybe enter into the process here, and then it'll leave. And a lot of times it may not be deliberate. You know, it's just sort of like, and then it'll be gone. You know,
the comedy was there in, say, Anton's Uncles, But when you moved on from Chekhov, I mean, the word I've got, certainly in this one, but it was there elsewhere, is there is a combination of all of this that the word romp seems to come to.
Romp.
That's a big romp.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a nice word. Well, it is a play, and play is a romp, in a sense. Yeah. So, I mean, there's always that sense of play that we're trying to achieve with the text, with the movement, with the actors, with the song, with the lyrics, with... You know, even the lighting and everything to keep things playful and lively so that, you know, we bring, for instance, a classic text to life by playing with it. Even like when the two of us start working together, we start to play with it. And then we have to keep that play going as we work with the actors and then as the audience comes in. But it is a romp. It's a juggle or a romp.
But wearing my critic's hat, so you can bounce this back to me if you want, but in all that work, if I was wearing that critic's hat, occasionally, but not a lot, the danger of a romp, even that word, is that you can blunder a bit. And once or twice in things, I thought, this has almost gone too far, and it's blundering, and then you pull it back. But is the danger that when you give yourself so much permission, it gets away from you a little?
Well, along with the... Yes, it certainly can. And who's to say where that line is, really? I'm sure it's different for everybody when they're watching it. But we do, as much freedom as we give ourselves as much restraint, 50-50, if not more so, restraint in what we're doing.
I think... Yeah. And I also think, like, the and as far as your question about it, you know, getting away from us, the challenge of doing something that, like, you're calling a romp or that has more of this cabaret feel is that, you know, how do we make this narrative or structure work in the way that people are used to and want to have a satisfying experience? I think that's... And it becomes a really interesting and challenging thing to pull off, you know? And so sometimes things can get away from us and maybe they don't get tied up as neatly as people like to see. When we do an adaptation of a play, like a Chekhov play or the Tennessee Williams play, the structure is already very soundly put in place. And our deconstruction of that uses that as the backbone. But when we're doing an adaptation of a myth, and we've done in other ones, it's looser, it's open, and it's not as kind of highly defined in terms of the beginning, middle, and end of these things. And that gives us a great liberty to do just about anything. But at the same time, yeah, we're always trying to find that balance and hope that we can kind of corral it into the structure that works.
But in, say, Anton's Uncles, I felt it was deliberate. There was play, but there was more of a collage quality and more of a tapestry quality, whereas you've really given us a very accessible, generous narrative at the heart of Grail Project.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I think another thing that has progressed over the years, too, is more music being added, and I think that also lends itself to this kind of the spirited energy that's in it. You know,
and when they're singing and moving as one, that, well, that's a romp, but there's a sort of such a richness about it, isn't there? When you start taking the elements, and suddenly, I mean, I think once I called you a many-legged beast called performance, and that was happening in this show as well. Yeah. That's quite a lot to mix up in the same bowl.
It is, and but when we look at myths, that's a huge mix of things in a bowl that's very, very deep. In the research that we did, I mean, it just was endless how many different iterations of the story there were and just how many modern adaptations there have been of these tales as well. And so what were we going to bring to it that was fresh or new? And even still, as we're working on it here in the festival and hopefully beyond this time, the myth keeps informing. Do you know what I mean? It's endless.
Yeah.
It doesn't. There's no end point to it, which is how we find most of the myths we work on, like the Greek myths we've done and this one as well. We will keep working on it.
And also, particularly with Grail Project, and particularly, you know, we're not far from Rosalind Chapel and some of the Grail conspiracy theories and so on. even not just the Disney-fied version of, you know, King Arthur, but some of the intelligent ones, you could almost accuse them of a cover-up. Because when you open the veil from those, we've got some really, well, I mean, actually heretical views of reality here, haven't we?
Yeah. No, it's true. And I think that that whole idea, I think, informed our version of it, too. Because in ours, it's we don't follow the strict Percival search for the Grail and his solo story that takes place in the original text that it appeared. We use a newcomer into the scene who becomes kind of this vehicle, we hope, for the audience to kind of enter into it. And it becomes sort of heretical as well, because he says this is all a load of bunk. You know, this whole Camelot thing is falling apart and I need to do my own searching, and that's my Grail quest that needs to happen. And I think that kind of history that's been going around, it did help to inform us in making this.
And also, you know, the common man in so many of those things is quite a sort of average of everybody. But this common man is, you know, the place we all know that's hidden inside us that we're not that proud of.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's been a great part of doing this project, is just kind of, you know, finding that link and then going, all right, how are we going to kind of massage that, nurture that in our narrative, and because it's, you know, it's that kind of the Joseph Campbell era that we were a part of. We were maturing in, Tina and I, you know, and you sort of, it was influential then. And then how does it affect today's audience? It's a different kind of thing, you know. So,
do you want work like this very consciously to, beyond it being entertaining and being powerful as the experience of art, given what's going on in the world at the moment, do you want your work to actually have an effect on people that might affect their behavior socially?
Yes, and hopefully we leave space for people to make up their own minds about what they feel and think about what they've just seen. Whereas, like what Richard was saying earlier, we don't make thesis work. Like, we're not trying to give you a message that you're going to come away with and say, oh, this is what this meant and this is what I should do. We give people options, we give people space, and hopefully kind of trip the awareness or the consciousness or the playfulness in the mind and the heart so that people can make up their own decisions. That's really what
but
I would
also,
like.
And you've maintained the sort of the royalty and the images and the mood of a myth, but our royal family here and our hero, our Percy, is, yeah, there's a bathos there, you know.
Yeah.
He's a bit like the modern versions of us, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that, you know, one thing that's we've talked about over the years of making work, and in this one it certainly applies, and that's that we like to create things that represents the human qualities. That's why we've loved doing Chekhov, Tennessee Williams. These writers, they clearly understood people, and we want our shows to have the humor and the kind of, you know, the excitement that we like to see in theater, but also to just kind of portray the human condition as we're seeing it. And so it's always about human relationships. I mean, even as stylized as it is, Tina's always working with the actors to, like, we have to, you know, find this sort of, this truth that's in there too, because that's really, I think, what I hope the audience, you know, connect with. You know, it's like these many stories have many different qualities and messages in them, but it's just like, how do we behave with each other, and let's see that and observe that, you know?
This question's gonna, I think it's gonna render you both speechless. So we could just have the wind in the trees here if you want. But I've seen your work over years, actually, at the Fringe. And when I look at you now, and I notice the actors coming out, but particularly you two, you haven't aged a day. And I'm just wondering, does this work, this approach, actually keep you fairly young in a sort of Peter Pan way? See?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, certainly when you're doing something you love, it definitely keeps you happy, and maybe
yeah,
that's
something
you
more
happy
than this.
Well, it's a quest we're on. Something, and I don't know exactly what it is, but it's a thing we have to do.
No, but seeing the way anyone can come and see this, you are skilled, you are able, you have, you know, background experience, but what appears on the stage is play, as you've said. It's very playful. Yeah. It's kind of the play that, you know, I remember my kids doing. The permission, the not being too sensible until maybe quite further down the process, is very rare.
Well, we could get into my childhood, and I could tell you that I didn't get to play as much as I would have liked.
Okay, so you're a burst balloon, and it's all, yes, still, all the gas is still coming out.
All the gas is still coming out.
Well, we don't have to discuss that.
No, but I'm interested because it's about also transferring a bit of wisdom. But you've told me before about the rehearsal process, and of course you have discipline. But what comes out, what you were doing with Anton's uncles, was a lot. It was respectful, but it was a lot of permission. And not a lot of, I'd call it like precondition. The structure that goes into directing often creates a hierarchy that becomes restricted. The actors then follow rules, and what comes out can be excellent and competent, but it doesn't shimmer.
Well, we have rules. I put those in little quotation marks. But just like sports have rules. So those rules are so that you can play the game.
Right.
And that's how the discipline is used in our work, I think. And it's also used just to make what-ifs, the magic what-if, Stanislavski's what-if. That's play, and we use a lot of that in our work.
And I think, you know, when you see the rehearsal process, when you know, oftentimes, you know, Tina's there, of course, all the time rehearsing, and I come in at different times, and it's such a... There's so much fun being had there. I mean, the two of us are there, are really enjoying, and there's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of that kind of energy that's in the room, and I think that goes back to, you know, how does, you know, is there a fountain of youth that we're you know, finding in theater? And there is. It is true when you do the things that are close to you, but you are serious about it. It's amazing how much pleasure and joy you get out of it.
So, as a writer, when you're writing this show, sight gags, but also, you know, verbal gags spoken, did you ever find yourself bursting out laughing at your own funniness?
No, I don't think I do, but I know when I get her to laugh when she reads something, then I know I've got something that's good. Yeah,
yeah, because the opposite can happen. You can write really funny stuff, and anyone that saw you would see you frowning, like it's the end of the earth. But
yeah.
But the writing process, then, are you giving yourself permission when you write, as much as, say, is being given permission to play in the actual physical space?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's always, and you know, we've been working long enough together that, you know, Tina's always encouraging it more. A lot of times things get written, it's like, all right, well, this was funny, but we need more funny. Let's just keep going here with this. You know, that kind of direction. And yeah, there's a permission to go anywhere. It's interesting, when we first did this show, you know, I wrote furiously and came up with, you know, 25 scenes, and it was a work in progress presentation we were going to do. And I knew that they weren't all ready, you know, but Tina said, you know, we're going to do all of them. We're going to put them up, and we're going to get them on its feet, because that's where we start to see whether things really work or not. And it was a great kind of process to then, you know, as a writer, you know, you've got a director who's like, I'm going to do everything here, even if it's not right. And then we get to see it, and then I get a chance to write again after having seen this thing up. And it's amazing. That's a great liberty to have in this process.
I interviewed a guy called Nick Hennigan, who's got three shows here, working with Guy Masterson, and he's adapted A Christmas Carol. He's adapted a couple of Shakespeare's, and he was talking about the process of adapting. But he was also talking about, it's not a particularly strong mission, but a wish to bring those classic things, like the myths as well, to a modern audience that would otherwise ignore them. Is that in your work?
Definitely. I know for myself, I mean, I have a Greek heritage, so myths are important to me, something I grew up with, and I'm just drawn to bringing these things to life, as well as I like Chekhov and things like that too, but I want it to be updated so that people can be exposed to it who otherwise would not be. Yeah.
And final question then, where does this go? Is this then, because I don't think, unless you find the Grail, you're going to stay eternally immortal in this film. So do you not, to be in this place, do you not think too deeply ahead? Do you not worry about what am I going to be 10 years from now? Do you worry, or do you have a vision for Theatre Movement Bazaar going somewhere radically different, or just saying, right, it's over now, and we're going to go back to a Greek island, you know, and retire? Is there a sense of where this leads beyond the next couple of shows?
We have these discussions about, you know, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, and we're so busy working, making the work.
Oh, it's a lame excuse.
but it's true. We get so caught up in making the work. Maybe
it's easier for us. It is a hard question to answer, and I think we have a hard time being able to answer that because, you know, and so it's easier for us to do the shows, you know, and that's a big and I think we're really wanting to reach. You know, more audience. That's always our thing.
But Vladimir and Estragon, you know, just wait because he might come tomorrow.
Yeah.
Another day.
are you Vladimir or am I
Vladimir?
I'm lucky.
Yeah, exactly. We'd live a home, you know, in a place where we can, you know, rehearse and put up our shows and then tour, and we'd like to have people on staff full time, year round. We love all those things that a lot of theater groups would love, and we try to work toward that, but don't always achieve it. But yeah, the one thing we have to keep doing is making the work. So we do that.
I suppose the reason I'm asking is, having gone through a bit of a life-threatening situation a couple of years ago with illness, and then coming through that, I do remember moments where I allowed myself for the first time to imagine ahead, and some of what came to me. Well, here we are talking about the Grail, but what came to me suddenly gave me ideas about where I might go next that I had no idea about and were uncomfortable. And when I decide to carry on in the same direction or different one, I'm glad those options became available rather than just, you know, the brilliance of busyness in the moment. I'm sort of trying to challenge you here in this graveyard as we sit around dead people.
Well, I'd love to continue working with young people and have them carry it on. Do you know what I mean? I don't want it to end with the two of us. I would like something to continue after we're gone, that we kind of opened up a different way of making theater than the usual path.
So you're going to put the sword in the stone and for someone else to pull out.
Pull it out, yeah. I think that's always so wonderful. I know both of us had, you know, teachers and mentors that helped us along the way and
inspired us
and continued to inspire us, and I would hope that we could do something like that.
So it's a vision of succession.
Yeah, and keep it going and keep an avenue of theater making that isn't traditional supported in some way. Yeah. Would be really nice.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a big thing for us. It's the what does the magic of theater offer that no other medium can, and you know, and we certainly embrace that in creating, you know, a total experience using everything we can from these actors and their talents and their skills to make something, we need more of that, we feel, in the theater scene, you know, and hope that our kind of work inspires people in that direction.
So the Theatre Movement Bazaar isn't just selling stuff, it's an invitation too.
Yeah.
That's great.
Definitely.
Thanks for talking to Fringe Review.
Thank you.